welcome back to Project Room, the podcast where we, Gareth, Miles and I, talk about film, cinema and TV till we're blue in the face. Gareth, is your face blue?
It's not, but you say my name twice. That's amazing. No, it's not blue. It is cold outside. So it could be turning blue, and I'm just not aware of that.
Well, by the end of the show, it might be, because then we would have fulfilled the criteria. The show is 205. It's Thursday, the 5th of March, due to a Wednesday night cock-up last night on my part. Sorry, everyone. And it is show 205. I already said that. Projectorroom.co.uk is our website, where you will find all sorts of lovely stuff that is in the links way, the way of links. MeWe Group is where we scoop up most of the stuff that we are talking about. Irf and Ali in the group fed back on the last show. He said, The Beyond, 1981, for It Is What You Were Talking About, was my first foray into horror, Gareth.
What?
I watched the first 10 minutes at my uncle's video rental shop, and I was hooked.
Ah.
Amazingly.
Right, okay, so it was his first, it's not, he didn't watch it recently and then suddenly go, I'm going to go try and go and investigate this horror genre at the tender age of Irfan's what?
I don't know how old he is.
30? 40?
No idea. I can't remember if I ever asked him. Amazingly, years later, he goes on in uninterrupted, I had the pleasure of meeting David Warbeck in person at a film festival. Very charming guy, says Irfan.
Shut the front door.
With lots...
He's met David Warbeck.
Very charming guy with lots of stories. Rumour had it he was in the running for James Bond, but lost out to, he thinks, Roger Moore.
I can elaborate on that if you wish me to, but I wouldn't dare interrupt you. Carry on.
And a last note to me, he says, Ted, you should check out Orphan Black if you like Titania Maslany, as per notes on last show's Keeper, what we were talking about, as she plays about 10 roles. She's a really good actress. I did actually have a quick look at Orphan Black, and I realised that I'd started watching it before, so I watched one episode and kind of gave up at the same point, really. It wasn't really for me, but I did note that she was a good actress. Right, you can now talk about James Bond.
Well, David Warbeck, he's quite the commodity. He is a wonderful actor, and it's strange how he just sort of bleeds into things that you're doing. Obviously, the story about James Bond is kind of up in the air, but from what I can gather from various different sources and books that I've read, and a particular book that I happen to have one of very few copies of, which is a biography about David Warbeck, it says that David Warbeck was kept on retainer by United Artists, who made the James Bond films at the time. And what they would do is, whenever Roger Moore was coming in to negotiate the salary, they would say, well, how much are you looking for this film? And Roger would say, $2 million would be fine. And they would go, we could do you $1.5 million. And he would go, no, $2 million or I walk. And they go, right, okay, well, we've got David Warbeck sitting there, so we'll just bring him in. Bring in David Warbeck. And Roger Moore would then go, right, okay, I'll do it for $1.5 million. So they pay David Warbeck to have him do that over a couple of the films. But it meant that Warbeck couldn't go and take larger jobs. So we ended up doing episodes of TV shows like Minder and stuff like that to, you know, keep in his insurance and stuff like that. But he couldn't go and give himself wholly over to a film that was going to take, you know, a year to make or whatever, with all the publicity and stuff, because he was under contract, and it deeply affected his career that way. But he could flitter off to Italy and make The Beyond or Ark of the Sun God or something like that might take a couple of weeks, and then come back again and not have to worry about things. And he was just getting a nice little bung from Cuppy Broccoli to be there whenever he needed him. So that's something that they do to keep negotiation smooth between Starz and the films. But there was something I was watching quite recently. Steve Coogan did a live stand-up show a couple of years ago. It was sort of out of nowhere. They did this live random show. I think it was Alan Partridge live on stage. And if you watch that, there's a segment in halfway through it where he's showing off, you know, fashion, Alan Partridge style fashion. And they show a load of pictures of David Warwick because he was a catalog model as well back in the late '70s. Yeah. And it was just bizarre. Why is David Warwick in the middle of this? Mm-hmm. Is there some gag there that I'm completely missing? But he's a great actor, and I'm very envious of Irfan Ali getting to meet Mr. Warbeck when he was alive, because he passed away at quite an early age, which was deeply unfair.
Mm, very sad. Yeah. Right, okay, well, thank you for that, Irfan. Certainly generated some conversation there, so well done indeed. Right, our new section called News. The first time we did it, we had about six stories. The second time was about four stories. Last time we forgot altogether, and now we're down to two dubious ones.
Well, the last show was really quite long, so I figured I'll whack in a couple of stories that might generate quite a bit of chat, as opposed to trivial stuff that we might try and stretch out or something. So I'll let you start first with your exciting one.
Oh, no, it's not very exciting. It's a Guardian report that reckons that more of us are watching YouTube on televisions now than on any other medium. So not laptops, not phones, not tablets, nothing like that. We're all putting it on our telly. And this did ring true with me, because that is absolutely true for me. My YouTube time is in the evening, sitting in front of the television with my remote control in my hand, the app on my Roku box, and that's when I watch YouTube. Now, that's not strictly true. If I'm doing some research in the day for a phone or something, I might jump in and quickly look at something, but 95% of the time, probably more, I'm following this pattern, and they reckon that they've done this research with all sorts of age groups, and there are varying numbers between age groups, but the YouTube viewing for over 55s, for example, has just gone up and up. What else have we got here? The stats are showing the 16 to 34-year-olds are more likely to be using it. Anyway, I'll put a link in the show notes if you want to drill down to the stats. But does this ring true with you? Do you or your family, you know, are they more likely to watch YouTube on a telly?
Absolutely, yes. I think there's two ways to look at this. But yes, the main way I would watch YouTube is on my TV now, and even to the point where if there's a YouTube video that I want to watch and I'm not near my TV, I'll be sticking it on my watch later list, and then when I get to my TV, I will watch it back. And that goes for shorts as well. I rarely watch shorts on my phone, but I think that where people are using their phone, they're tending to use shorts like TikTok or, what's the other one, on Facebook, is it Reels or something like that, or Instagram. They kind of scroll that way. And then whenever they're done with that and they're sitting down in front of the TV, that's whenever YouTube comes on. And they're not using YouTube on their phone anymore, because YouTube is, they're bigger videos. I keep sitting down and going, right, what am I going to watch now? Oh, that's 20 minutes long. I don't know if I want to spend 20 minutes watching a YouTube video right now. I'd rather watch this. It's only 4 minutes long. So, you know, I think people are just, they get comfortable, settle down and go, right, I'm going to devote half an hour to watching this video now.
Yes, I think you're right. And, of course, it's you're more likely to get more content in landscape TV shape format. So it just makes sense. It's okay to flick through TikTok on your phone, because it kind of lends itself to that. But yes, there you go then. We're the same. I haven't even got an aerial in my TV. I've not got a TV license.
Me neither.
And
I have a TV license.
That's all I kind of do, really. Anyway, that was the story. It's in The Guardian. Link in the show notes. What have you got?
It's the big story about Netflix pulling out of the Warner Brothers deal, and it looks like Paramount is set to somehow dump up $111 billion, you know, because whenever you're broke, you've got that, to take over Warner Brothers. Paramount has no money. Larry Ellison is coughing up this cash along with his son, who is the CEO of Paramount. That's David Ellison. So that they can make the purchase, because you know, roll into a bank and withdraw your savings and things like that, and have $111 billion.
Wow.
It's one of those things that's got everyone really worried, like what's going to happen here. But there's some things that are happening. You know, there's fees that need to be paid. Netflix is actually getting $3 billion for this, which is bonkers, because it didn't go through, and they weren't able to take on the debt and all that kind of stuff. Because Warner Brothers, it's not just about buying Warner Brothers; you're buying their debt too. And Netflix eventually walked away from it, but they got $3 billion for all their negotiations so far, which is easy money. Mm. But it was announced that Paramount lost about $570 million in the last quarter. And perhaps Netflix is thinking that if they wait it out, they might be able to buy both Paramount and Warner Brothers for around about the same amount of what they were looking to pay for Warner Brothers.
Brilliant.
The Warner Brothers CEO, Zaslav, said that he's gone on the record to say that the deal may not pass, but Warner Brothers will get $7 billion from the breakup fee from the Netflix possibility there. And Zaslav I don't think he's going to stick that money into developing feature films. I think he'll be handing that money out to the shareholders so that they at least get something before Warner Brothers goes tits up. But it'll be interesting to see what happens going forward. At the moment, I think the only positive about Paramount buying Warner Brothers is, and I'm reading this into it, is Paramount's quite good at releasing physical media. Netflix is fucking terrible at it. They don't like to do it, because why would they release a Blu-ray of something like that whenever they want you to go to subscribe to their streaming service to watch it? So Paramount has a whole arm of that, and Warner Brothers as well have a really big arm of physical media. So hopefully the two of them manage to come together and arrange some sort of forward-thinking physical media arm so that people are buying it, because once again this quarter, sales of physical media are on their way back up again, because people are wanting to cancel the whole Netflix and streaming thing. So I'm hoping that the tables are finally turning, but that could be down to the idea that, you know, Gen Z, who are now running out to get DVDs and VHSs and things like that, are just going into charity shops and buying them all there. They're not quite going to Amazon or boutique Blu-ray stores online to buy the big expensive Blu-rays and things that are coming on. They're quite happy just picking up an old DVD copy of Swordfish and taking that home for £1, and that's them. They've got that film, they can watch it anytime they like. They don't have to pay any streaming costs whatsoever. TV shows and that sort of thing, they're grabbing all of those big box sets of The Wire and Breaking Bad and stuff, taking those home. So if you have media or physical media still, you might be lucky. That might be worth a bit of money in the future, because the price of it is going back up. What do you think, Ted?
These things go in cycles, don't they? Because,
yeah,
you know, in 5 years' time, we'll be reporting the opposite thing, and, you know, DVDs are dead, and no one's buying physical media, and the streaming services have wised up, and they want that they've made it more attractive, and blah blah blah.
How is that going to really sit in the mouths of the customers? You know, there's a term for this now that seems to be rampant at the moment called enshittification, where you pay for something, a service, and gradually things get worse. A perfect example is Amazon Prime, where you pay for a monthly subscription, and now you're getting ads in that monthly subscription, and the same with Netflix. You know, that's enshittification happening. So if they start to lose their customer base, and they go, right, well, we'll just remove the adverts and get people back on again, who's going to, in the right mind, go back on and go, oh, I'll quite happily jump back on board then?
I think it depends
as soon as they go back up, they start throwing ads at you.
I think it depends on the content creation, though, because if Amazon are making stuff that people really want to see, and they're not putting it onto optical discs or physical media, then people will still want to see it, because their friends will be talking about it at school or down the pub or whatever, and so the only way you can watch it is on Amazon. And the same thing would be true of Netflix if they decide to stick with their policy. I think you're seeing this from the perspective of someone that is really into physical media. I'm looking at it from the perspective of people that Joe Public probably doesn't really care about physical media. Now, I do accept that Gen Z might change that. Fair enough. Okay. But up till now, we haven't had that argument. I think that Joe Public just doesn't give a stuff, as long as they can watch somehow what they want to watch. And it's been proven that people outside of me and you seem to be okay with watching adverts. I just can't I can't believe it, that people have YouTube subscriptions and just watch adverts, and it would just drive me nuts.
Oh yeah, absolutely. But then on the other side of that, the whole rise and success of streaming media, let's not forget, both Amazon and Netflix originally got their audience by having a huge catalogue of movies, not through creating their own stuff. Whenever they became a movie studio themselves, they changed exactly what they were. Mm-hmm. You know, if Paramount back in the late 90s was to say, you have to be a member of Paramount to be able to watch Paramount movies, you would have gone, no way, sod Paramount, I'm not having anything to do with that. I want to be able to buy whatever media I want to buy. But Netflix did that slowly over the course of time, and now you're watching Netflix exclusives, a bit like BBC iPlayer. They have an array of films that they have for a small period of time, but that's it. Everything else there is stuff that they're producing themselves. So they're a movie studio with a captured audience, and they're losing that audience. And I think that people will start to wise up whenever they're going, well, there's nothing I want to watch here, or I've seen everything that's good, so what do I do next? And they don't like the idea of you swinging from tree to tree and moving from Disney Plus to there to there. People don't want to watch Disney Plus, and they're losing subscribers left, right, and centre. The only people who are stuck on Disney Plus are families with young kids, who don't really get what's happening in Star Wars or Marvel. You know, it'll be interesting to see what happens. Sorry, I'm going down a tangent. Gold to it.
We've got no time for the rest of the show now, so
yeah,
thank you for listening, everyone. It's been really nice bringing you today's news department.
See the news, it's such a time consumer, sorry.
Right, let's go to suggested viewing and reviews from our lovely listeners. And we're going to start, you're going to start with Shudder Trio from Phil Harding, aren't you, Gareth?
Well, yes. Well, you did ask me at the start of the show if I was blue-faced. Well, I'm a little red-faced, because it turns out that Phil Harding is an old pal of mine from years ago. Mm. And I just thought it was a coincidence he had the same name as someone I grew up with. But it's not. It's the same person. And he actually lives closer to you now than he does to me. So, mm-hmm. yeah. Phil has watched Together from 2025, which is a body horror starring a real-life actor couple, Dave Franco and Alison Brie. Oh, I remember. We had this in Coming Soon.
We did, yeah.
And Alan was a bit kind of squeamish about it. Mm-hmm. The pair are having relationship trouble, so they move from the big city to a rural community to try to get closer together. Turns out the locals have a freakish marriage cult that literally fuses people together. Some really good practical effects on display in this, and convincing performances from the leads.
You don't find out about that until about 4/5 through the film. That's a real spoiler alert, that is.
Oh, sorry, I did not.
It's not you. I'm blaming Phil. But anyway, it is. I have seen it, and it's a really good film. And when the reveal comes, which everyone knows now that listens to this, it's really quite shocking. What on earth is going on here? And he's right. The effects are done really well. So I recommend that as well as Phil does.
Cool. Well, Phil also watched The Ugly Stepsister from 2025, a really dark alternative to Bridgerton. This is a Norwegian production, best with subtitles, not dubbing. It's darkly funny. It's a darkly funny take on the Cinderella story with some of the most toe-curling, shocking body horror I've ever seen. We're meant to root for the ugly sister, I think. Ted, I've got a funny feeling you've seen this
Yeah, I have, and it was an absolute scream. I watched it this week. It's on, and again, it's on. All of these are on Shudder, it is a take on the Cinderella story, but the Cinderella character kind of switches around in the middle of the film and then back again, and it's all, and then it gets a bit kind of darkly dark, and I'm not going to say anything more, because in the last half hour it really comes to life, and I sat there kind of almost open mouthed, eyes wide, watching what was going on, and it's worth watching. I think you can almost just watch the last half hour, to be honest. The rest of it was a little bit boring at times, but yes, it's Norwegian. Good shout again, Phil.
Is the stepsister really ugly?
They've made her look ugly, yeah, by making her up that way. But of course, you know, as the film goes on, as the characters switch around, she becomes less ugly. You need to watch it to understand what's going on, really.
Okay, it's not like that Taming of the Shrew or whatever. Was this Shakespeare one where they have the really ugly person and it turns out they're actually really beautiful?
The Ugly Duckling. There once was an ugly duckling. I don't know anything about Shakespeare. I'd like to tell you that when I went to school, not once did anyone in all the schools I went to and all the classes I went to mention Shakespeare. I know nothing about Shakespeare.
Well, whenever you went to school, had Shakespeare written anything? Sorry. Right, so Skinamarink is the next one Phil has watched. This much-hyped Canadian experimental horror takes its inspiration from common nightmare tropes based on crowdsourcing social media responses. The result is disjointed, and I had to read the plot synopsis to follow it. Good. Two kids have been seemingly abandoned in their house with parents nowhere to be found. Some of the imagery is quite creepy. It's not really an entertaining watch. It's more of an arty, beard-stroking curio. I remember this coming out and people saying that it was the most terrifying thing they had ever seen until it was actually released, and then people stopped talking about it quite quickly. Ted, you've watched this.
It's a bit spooky. I do agree with Phil that it is quite creepy, and the imagery is where all the power of it is. I got fed up with it. I started watching it. But it's just, it's kind of arty-farty, and it's a bit off the wall for me, or rather off the ceiling in this case. There's lots of strange camera angles and just, yeah, it's quite, you should give it a go, Gareth. You might get more out of it than me and Phil clearly have.
Yeah, well, I didn't realize it was on Shudder, but I see that written across the middle of the poster. Maybe I did and just forgot about it and hasn't popped up on my feed in a while. But I noticed the director, Kyle Edward Ball, he's making another one called The Land of Nod that sounds equally as scary. We'll just go with that.
Okay. Anyway, thanks a lot, Phil. Nice little trio of recommendations there. Right, next up is Chad Dixon on Send Help, 2026 film, cinemas only for now. And I'll put a link in the show to Chad's full review on my blog, of which the following is an edit. We put this into Coming Soon. Just thought I'd remind you of that.
Well, because it's Sam Raimi's new film and Bruce Campbell's in it.
Indeed. Sam Raimi is back in the director's chair with his survival horror thriller that starts like an office rom-com but quickly descends into a bloody nightmare. Rachel McAdams stars as Linda Liddell, a tireless but unappreciated corporate analyst. When her arrogant new boss, Bradley Preston, played by Dylan O'Brien, bypasses her for a well-deserved promotion, giving it instead to his frat buddy, Donovan, whatever that means, Linda... Ugh. Linda...
No, sorry, Donovan is just a horrible name.
Oh, I see. No, I meant...
Sorry, Donovans.
Linda is incandescent with rage. That's a good word, isn't it? Linda is incandescent with rage. Despite the tension, she's roped into a high-stakes business trip to Bangkok. The flight takes a dark turn when the executives begin mocking a video of Linda's audition for a survival reality show. Seconds later, this is the bit I remember from our Coming Soon. Seconds later, catastrophic decompression rips the plane apart, and we all thought that bit was done quite well. In a harrowing sequence, Linda watches her colleagues get sucked into the night before the jet ditches into the ocean. Linda wakes up on a tropical beach, only to find her boss, Preston, nearby with a shattered leg. This is where the movie shifts gear, says Chad. Linda's obsession with survival shows pays off. She becomes the protector, while the invalid Preston is forced to rely entirely on the woman he dismissed. True to Raimi's style, the third act delivers plenty of a wince-inducing gore and gross-out humour that earned big laughs in the cinema. While the ending feels a bit predictable, McAdams and O'Brien carry the film with high tempo, believable performances. It's a grisly, entertaining survival film, perfect for a rainy afternoon, and Chad gives it his solid recommendation. So, yes, I remember us watching that. I think Alan was still here then, and we all thought that scene of the plane breaking up was actually done quite well. Do you remember that?
Oh, absolutely. I'm dead excited about this. I just haven't been able to fit it in to be able to go to the cinema to see it. But I will make a point of doing it. I am wondering, is rated 15 or 18, just how gory it is? Because I do have a sensitive wife who tends to turn pale at the sight of blood now in her old age.
Oh, dear.
She doesn't listen. Well, it's rated R, so yeah, I'll probably have to watch this on my own.
Okay, then. We'll just wait till it comes on a 4K DVD, which you can buy because you're not... No, let's not go there again. Right, who's next?
The last one here is from Kyle Leong, who has written in about the Auditors, which is a 12-episode Netflix TV series, which has 1 hour... episodes each. Hang on a second. There we go. I'll try and get it all on the one page. You have to hand it to the Koreans. Who else can make a highly watchable series about auditors? Shin Hae Kyun, plays the no-compromise audit team leader determined to clear out corruption. He transforms the team members to follow the true spirit of auditing. I've said audit three times so far, and I'm struggling to stay away. It's nothing to do with you, Carly. It's just audit. Ugh. As the film uncovers case after case of corruption, it leads to one of the biggest, one within the firm that employs them. All the way to the top, I tell you. The drama moves quickly along at a quick pace, and it teases us to binge it all in one go. The lead is a multi-award-winning actor. He plays the poker-faced team leader who is hard as nails on the outside but soft beneath. A bit like an armadillo! Sorry. Stupid night tonight. There are twists in each of... Harry Enfield, wasn't it? There were twists in each of the cases to keep you guessing, though some can be obvious and for a seasoned audience. Highly enjoyable series. Ted, let me guess, you've tried this.
I whenever Carl Leong puts something in the group, I feel that I should have a go and watch it, because no one else ever seems to comment on it or know anything about it. So... whenever he does that, I make a point of going and trying to watch at least one episode. And I think, personally, that the problem with this is that I there's so much dialogue in it that, and everything, because I guess it's an auditing team and they're office-based and whatever, it's all really quick fire. And trying to read the subtitles while that's going on, was just it wasn't impossible, but I spent all my time looking at the bottom of the screen and none of my time looking at the what was actually going on. You need to watch it twice to kind of anyway. Laying that aside, it does look as though it's pretty well made, interestingly executed. The cinematography is really good, so lots of nice camera work, angles, lighting and special effects, all of that side of it's done really well. And also the acting was very good. I do totally agree. And it's also interesting to learn more about the Korean culture. I always come back to this one, but I really enjoy the way they speak, their intonation in their voices. It's really good. And Mr. Hard-Nosed Shin Kai-kyun, he really is, you know, the hard-nosed. He's really ruthless, and that's quite good fun watching him. That comes out even in the first episode. I just think it would have been much more enjoyable if I could understand Korean. That's what I should do. Go and learn Korean so that I don't have to read the subtitles.
Yes.
But yeah, it's very, very talky, loads of dialogue. So I try not to put subtitles on these things. I'd rather enjoy it as it is, in good Alan style. But with this one, maybe that's what you need to do.
I hadn't realised that. It's from 2024. Maybe I read that out and just didn't take it in. But, yeah, I've never heard of it before.
No. Well, it's these obscure kind of Korean things, which, as I said at the top, really, I do appreciate Carl Leong bringing these to the group because, like I say, no one else does. And I quite like to have a go at these Korean things because some of them, sometimes you just find a pearl amongst swine.
Yes, quite right.
Right, Fandom Focus is next, and it's my turn. And I have always been a great fan of the feature films of Monty Python.
Hey.
Monty Python and the Holy Grail, 1975. The Life of Brian, 1979. The Meaning of Life, 1983. And I'm going to add one that is one of the kind of offshoots from one of the members of the team, or two members, or three members. And that's Jabberwocky from 1977, because I also thought that was really, really in keeping with the quality of the other three films. Now, we've spoken about Monty Python and the Flying Circus TV show quite a few times on the show, and we've always said that a lot of it misses. There's some great sketches going on in the TV show, 12 series of it, and it's like... No, sorry, four series of it, with each one with 12 in it. And a lot of the sketches just miss. They're not funny, but most of the rest of it kind of holds up and it works quite well. Well, When it came to these three films, or four if you include Jabberwocky, it all just seemed to come together, that they put their writing hats on and their thinking hats on, and they spent a lot of time. I don't know the backstory about the money or how they produced it or how long they took to do all this, but the point is that it all comes together. And there's hardly, on all these films, there's hardly a thing done wrong. It just, every scene is funny, every line is funny almost. The Meaning of Life gets some bad press because they kind of, most people kind of think that's the weak link in the trio. But actually, I think The Meaning of Life is really good, and it's got lots of good stuff going on it. But it is different. I was first introduced to these films with The Holy Grail, obviously, because it was the early one. But the one that impacted me most was The Life of Brian, which had all the hoo-ha from the religious people, of course. And because of that, I think I got stuck into it even more, and it was just, I found it like it was my badge of anti-religion stuff, even though they had got it wrong and it wasn't really about that at all. But anyway, that's a debate for another day. So The Life of Brian to me always was the favourite one. Jabberwocky, I couldn't believe that when I discovered Jabberwocky. It was just so funny. And furthermore, I watched these films so many times that I have worn out VHS tapes, you know, that you just watch and watch and watch them again. I knew the script for every sketch. I think I might have said before on the show, me and my friend, we actually performed some of these sketches and stuff on the stage, and it's just so funny. But the point is, the central point that I'll come back to is that, yes, it all came together. When they decided to make these full-length films, everything just seemed to come together in a way that it often missed in the TV show. And I shall always be a fan of the feature films of Monty Python.
Nope, I heartily agree with you. They are... Well, there's four Monty Python films, is there not? You've left off, and now for something completely different.
Which oh, that's is, just a bunch of sketches, isn't it?
It was, but it was a feature film that they put out to sort of introduce it to America, because it went out into an American cinema, so it does actually kind of, it makes sense to count it, and it's usually the strongest of sketches, so it's the best way to introduce people to the sketches who have maybe never seen them before. Mm. And whenever you're watching them, you'll know them best from the TV show, so they're all just that wee bit weirder. And they maybe don't have the timing that you remember quite so well. So it's a bit of an odd one to watch. But I know Meaning of Life the best.
Right.
And I love Holy Grail wholeheartedly. I've actually only seen Life of Brian a handful of times. I haven't seen it as often as maybe I should have. But I know Meaning of Life inside out, and I have the soundtrack, and I quite frequently quote little bits of it, you know, really obscure quotes as well. I just think that film, it does what And Now for Something Completely Different does, but with all new material, and you get a long episode of a TV show with a massive amount of sketches throughout. And you know, the TV show had ambitious sketches as well that kind of stretched on for almost half an episode, and you get that with The Meaning of Life, because there's really long sketches, like the Crimson Permanent Assurance is what, 25 minutes long, and that's the prologue to the film. You haven't even started the film by the time that's over. Yeah. I don't know that it was originally released with it attached to it, but it became part of the film the way
it was. I saw it at the cinema, and that was in the beginning of it.
But yeah, it's such an impactful series of films as well. But like you lump in Jabberwocky, I'm always looking for ways that you can, you know, dump in other films that are kind of Monty Python inspired, where it's got a few elements of it, and you're like, isn't Monty Python like Yellowbeard springs to mind, and even that, what was the one that they had? Was it The Wind in the Willows? I think actually the majority of the Pythons were in that as well. I think it was directed by Terry
Jones,
yeah, and he played Mr. Toad, Mr. Frog, Mr. Toad.
if you go off on a tangent, you can pull all sorts of stuff in, like ripping yarns and
Fish Called Wanda.
Yeah, yeah. Fish Called Wanda I had, before I cut this list down, I had a whole bunch of them, one assigned to each of these people. What was that?
Yeah.
There was that one that Graham Chapman did when he was the bored office worker. What was that called?
The one with Peter Cook, was that?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and I can't remember the name of it. But yeah, if you go off on a tangent, I thought that the Jabberwocky was the one, if I was going off on one tangent, that would be the one I was going to.
Time Bandits as well. You throw
Time Bandits, yep, yeah, that's right.
Even Brazil.
Yeah, Brazil is a really off-the-wall film. If you're going to go to Terry Gilliam's work, I think Brazil is quite hard work, whereas Jabberwocky is not. And there was that other one, Munchausen's...
The Adventures of Baron Munchausen. Yeah, I love that film. That's brilliant.
Well, that's another Gilliam thing, isn't it?
yeah. But yeah, it's a wonderful piece of history, and I wonder how well it's going to date. If the kids of tomorrow, I wonder if they will get it. I don't think they will. And I was talking about Holy Grail the other day. He must be a king. How do you know? He hasn't a chit all over him.
Yeah.
I used that in a sentence.
There is. There's some lovely filth down here. You could just, in my youth, we were just quoting at each other, me and my friends, all this stuff all the time. We just were so in love with it all.
Yeah. Oh, and I'd love to watch it again. I think they're all coming out in 4K. I urge you all to go out and buy them.
Anyway, that was my fandom focus. And next time it's your turn.
Terrific. Good call.
Flop of the fortnight, anything in there?
Yes. I'm going to throw in one that I've wanted to watch for a number of years. I remember as a kid, a friend of mine's older sister and her friends were really excited about this film coming out, and it had, well, I suppose at the time, maybe I just knew him from Hot Shots or something like that, or Ferris Bueller, but it had Charlie Sheen and Emilio Estevez, and they were dead excited about this because they were two really handsome young actors that the girls all loved. And I think they hired this out on video because it might have gone direct to video here in the UK. And it's always sat there as one of those films that maybe I should watch that, but I don't know if I fancy it that much. It's the two of them play garbage men, and it's a comedy that has action sequences in it, but I don't know that that's right. But I finally got around to sitting down and watching it, and I have to say it is a ginormous steaming pile of crap. It's written and directed by Emilio Estevez, and I think it's one of his first films on the back of his sort of celebrity starting to happen. And obviously he's cast with his half-brother, Charlie Sheen. And the two of them do have some chemistry on screen, but you would expect so much more from them. Keith David is in there as well, and he's almost like the sort of the third wheel on this comedy pack, and he is by far and away the best of the lot here. But it's one of those films that feels really like an extended sitcom, and it has some, I think, slightly passable gags here and there, but not enough to build a film around. It's about two garbage men who discover a body in the trash and realize that it's all connected to this conspiracy to dump toxic waste or something like that. And because they're garbage men, they get involved. But God, I checked out after about 40 minutes. I didn't laugh once. I might have smirked at the delivery of a line as opposed to a line, but everything's just so uncomfortable. You know, there's a moment where Charlie Sheen, who I have a bit of renewed faith in, because I loved that movie The Chase that I eventually got to see, because he's so good in that. Here he's really awkward, and there's a there's a sequence where he has to run away from people with Leslie Hope, and the two of them are having an exchange as they're running away from something. And I think he's having to run slowly, but he's making it look like he's running fast and taking extra steps. But it just feels so awkward and weird. I think the whole film just is summarized by that scene, because none of it is funny. None of it feels natural. Everything that they go to do feels like it's the setup to a gag, and that gag doesn't pay off. It's an abomination. It really is poor as get out. And Emilio Estevez has proved himself to be a pretty decent director. There was a film that he made a couple of years ago called The Public, I think it was called, where that was a really well-made light comedy drama about a public library.
But, I saw that.
Yeah, it was well done. It was well made.
Yeah.
But this was just, it was wretched. Absolutely wretched. Don't bother with it. Have you ever heard of it or seen it?
No, it sounds dreadful. I was just trying to focus in on who Charlie Sheen is. Two and a Half Men. I think I've seen one episode of that at some point. So I know who he is in that. But
he's Martin Sheen's son. He's a bit of
who's
a problem
Martin Sheen?
Child. You know, from Apocalypse Now.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah. And he was in Being John Malkovich. I probably wouldn't know him from that, because he was the guy that was loafing about with the girl in that. So, yeah. Anyway, yet again, it's one of these kind of 80s people that you know really well and I have no idea about.
Well, you've seen Wall Street with Michael Douglas.
I think I might have done, but I couldn't.
Charlie Sheen's in that. He's the young, plucky young
I couldn't tell you.
Lad.
I couldn't tell you anything about it.
Young Guns, Hot Shots.
No. I've seen Hot Shots. Oh, is he the one that is jumping around with a strap around his forehead?
He's Topper Harley in that. He rides a Harley Davidson.
No.
Nearly seems.
You see, all of this is so long ago, and I've only ever seen it once, because it's not really my kind of thing, that I've just completely forgotten about it all.
Well,
anything in the 80s... Mind you, this is 1990. Yeah, okay, yeah. All right. 1 year
it was made
on.
During the 80s.
Anyway,
well, stay away from that one. Charlie Sheen's in better comedies around that time.
I can assure you I'll stay away from that one. Let's go to private screening. Your choice last time on the back of Robert Duvall passing away.
Well, yes, I wanted, and I have been wanting to revisit a film that I watched when I was actually quite young. I think it was on in the middle of the day, maybe on a Sunday afternoon on ITV or probably Channel 4 back around 1990 or so. And I'm a bit surprised that I had seen it, but I wanted to watch it again because I don't remember it particularly well, and I'd never really connected it to being, or I didn't know who Robert Duvall was when I first watched it at that time, but at my young age, I appreciated this as just a good film, and I wanted to watch it again because it's just a little slice out of life, a little tale that you're not going to find anywhere else, that someone might tell you, over the counter or whatever, whenever you're having a chat. You know, it's a bizarre little film that went on to big things because Duvall was, I think he actually got the Academy Award for it. And Tess Harper, it was her first film, and she was nominated for a bunch of different reviews or a bunch of different awards. Ellen Barkin is in there as well, quite a young Ellen Barkin. Wilford Brimley is in there too, still looking the same age as he would do for the next 20 years. Betty Buckley, who I did not recognize at all. It was afterwards when the names were on the screen that I was like, that was Betty Buckley? Wow. Doing some country and western singing. But it's about Duvall playing a broken down country singer who's hit the end of the line. He's an alcoholic. Well, he's not maybe an alcoholic, but he's got alcoholic problems, and he's broke, and he's destroyed, and his career is never going to come back. Although there's an opportunity for it, for him to potentially try, and he's got this this burning anger inside him, or this curiosity to know what would happen if he was to try. You know, could he recapture? And he's constantly at war with himself as to whether or not he should, because he knows the path that his character goes down in the story gives him everything that he needs in life. And it's almost a real second chance. Should he risk it all and try to recapture the magic that he had in years gone by? And we follow him for a couple of years as he dabbles with this, as he feels the difficulties of adapting to a modern life, and giving himself truly to someone that he loves. And it's a beautiful, sweet little story that doesn't do anything particularly elaborate. It doesn't have any hugely dramatic moments or anything. It's just such a small, nice little film that covers an interesting period of time in someone's life, after their star has faded. And I think it's an absolutely phenomenal movie. I really enjoyed watching it again. I really enjoyed the connection between all of the characters, as we get to see Duvall's character of Max Ledge, which is one of the coolest names in cinema, I have to say. And it's weird that it's in such a little downbeat drama and not some sort of big action movie. But as his character interacts with his old life and meets his ex-wife and deals with his family that came from that life before, as he moves into his new life with his new wife, Tess Harper, who is just a meek and quiet woman who has built a life for herself, and she's satisfied with that. She's content with that. And yeah, it's a wonderful movie, and I would implore anyone to give it a go if they haven't seen it and they just want that sort of lazy Sunday afternoon drama to tell them a nice little story. And Ted, from the amount of red I can see in the show notes, I've got a funny feeling that you didn't particularly enjoy this one.
Well, firstly, I don't know who any of these people are apart from Robert Duvall. So the same thing applies again. It's a 1983 film. It's full of 1983 people who you clearly know really well. And I've never heard of them. Betty Buckley and Tess Harper. I don't know who they are. And so you would have been turned on by the fact that, apart from anything else, apart from that it's full of these people you know. And I don't know any of them. Robert Duvall, I thought, his performance was okay. Incidentally, I spent the first 30 minutes of this kind of fighting to stay awake. It was just so boring and dull, and I was yawning and trying to keep my eyes open. It was just so, and you know, dated as well. Everything looks like it's you know, small town America again, and it's 1980s fashions and country music. If I had to choose one genre of music that I would be absolutely the bottom of my pile, you know, and when they started singing country music, and then they start on religion. All the religion comes out, because that's what they do in that part of America, apparently, or they did then. And I just don't get the whole scene. What I was going to say was, though, that his performance, I thought, was okay, but actually he looked, to my mind, as if he was about as bored doing it as I did watching it. And I can't believe that he's won. I had no idea that he'd won awards or Oscars or whatever for it. I didn't know that at all. But it's just,
produced the film.
It's just so boring. I hated this film. In the end, I got through half of it. And also, you should know that I can't stand films about show business people and about musical performers. You know, when I talked to you about that Ozzy Osbourne film I watched, I was vomiting blood because of that, and how tedious all these performers are. It was like watching paint dry. I couldn't stand it any longer after about 45 minutes. And it wasn't a long film. I could and should have stuck it out probably, but I was just so pissed off with how crap and boring it was, and I couldn't keep my eyes open hardly. And, you know, this is just one of the ones that I would score zero for, I'm afraid, if you let me score it.
Wow. Right, okay. So there's nothing redeeming about it at all.
I couldn't find anything. I did watch half of it, and I couldn't, apart from, yeah, okay, his performance seemed okay, but like I said, he wasn't trying very hard. He didn't appear to me to be trying very hard in the half of the film that I saw, and he looked bored doing it as well. It's like he was just like, this was a payday, an easy payday for him.
No, I think it was a really cheap movie, actually. I think they even used one car in it twice. I suppose this type of film isn't for everyone, and it depends on the mood that you're in whenever you sit down to watch it. I know that whenever we're doing these reviews, we can, and it's someone else has suggested, I generally find them more like homework, and if someone had told me to watch this whenever I could have been watching the Sorority Babes 3, then I... You know, I wouldn't be getting into this. It would be a chore, and I felt that. And I think Alan as well, whenever he was on, he would say that too. You know, you just can't get into it. You have to be in the mood to watch it. And it's more like you'll be told to do this.
I agree.
But it was wonderful to revisit this film, and I think it's an excellent film. I think Duvall is superb in it, and he just has that burning inside him. You can see him in behind his eyes. How upset he is over the or how what's the word? I can't think of what the word is. Or you know, you're at a crossroads, and you're trying to work out what you're going to do, and you know it just all works. And I'm sure you could read a lot more into it, but because it's a petrol filling station, you know, in the middle of nowhere, and that itself is essentially a crossroads, like in his life, and he can take one road and another road, and we get to sit with him as he chooses which one to do. But I think Duvall is just phenomenal. This is one of his particular must do's. Of films, you know, because he'd done The Godfather and things like that prior to this, and I think he wanted to do something that was just that just
you know, bored him,
increased his range. You know, the late 70s, he played a lot of sort of tough cops and things like that. So this was a much more gentle film, and I'm surprised at how gentle it is as well. You know, it is rated PG, and I think that's why I saw it so young, because it was on during the day. And it doesn't have anything that you would associate with, you know, a raw drama, you know, where he's maybe effing and blinding or something like that, or you know, as his star fails, his celebrity disappears, he's unable to function as a normal person, or there might be nudity or something like that.
Enough. I get that you like it, for fuck's sake. Bloody hell. It's like we're doing fan focus again here.
Well, no, I do wonder. I think it's country and western singers as well. There's something about torn up country and western singers, like that Crazy Heart with Jeff Bridges and Walk the Line and things.
You've got to be able to stomach country music though to begin with.
He doesn't sing that often. There's a couple of numbers, but it's
frankly,
not.
I'd rather watch Virgin River than this, and that's saying something.
All right, okay. Well, we'll go to the scores then, because I've got a funny feeling it might be low.
You better give it 15.
No, I'm going to give it 13. It's not perfect.
Not perfect.
I can't believe you can't find anything redeeming in this one.
Well, maybe it was all in the second half of the film, but in the first half of the film, it was shite.
Okay. All right. Well, we can put it in there, and it's in with What does it compare to?
All the Light We Cannot See, A Nearly Normal Family, The Gorge. I thought that was great. I don't know why YouTube marked that down. I love that.
You must have picked it.
Probably. And Awake. No, in The Gorge, we saw him Coming Soon, and I was immediately drawn to it, and so were you in Coming Soon. And then we came to watch it, you and Alan thought it was crap.
Yeah, because it was.
Well, that just goes to show that we're not going to ever agree on anything on this show.
But that'll be interesting going forward, won't it?
My pick for the next show is something that we both saw in Coming Soon and both said that looks really interesting. So don't you come back to me and say it was crap and I told you it would be crap. This is the thing called Scarpetta. And it's going to be arriving on Amazon Prime Video on the 11th of March, which is just in time, a week before our next recording. They're going to drop all 8 episodes on Amazon Prime. This is the thing with Jamie Lee Curtis and Nicole Kidman and Bobby Cannavale. I know who that is. You taught me who that is. A brilliant forensic pathologist uses forensic technology to solve crimes. When this was in Coming Soon, we kind of said, yeah, this looks good. And it'll be worth a look. So I'm generating that look.
All right. I was lying. I thought it looked crap.
Right. Let's go to themed treats. And I'm going to be the one that was leading on this. And I picked child actors. And child actors, because one of the reasons that got picked as a theme was because I wanted to have a look at Village of the Damned. And Village of the Damned 2, well, no, not 2, the remake. So the Village of the Damned, the first one, 1960, was a really super film, really well acted. It was frightfully kind of stiff upper lip, wooden, reflecting when it was made, I suppose. But it was very sinister. It was made in black and white, and there was some humour injected through it here and there. The kids in the film did okay. They did their job okay, but mostly, to be honest, they only had to stand still while kind of special effects crews glow their eyes. And clearly nobody was particularly stretched. They were given the brief of just stand there and look sinister, don't smile. And so they kind of did that. But the strength of this one over the remake in 1995, I think, is the not knowing. It's all very Hitchcockian again in the 1961, leaving the imagination to fill in the gaps. Unlike the later one, which I'll come to in a second, which kind of lays the whole backstory on a plate for the viewer. I haven't read the book that this is all based on, but I'm guessing that the 1960 version probably is more in keeping than the American-based 1995 one. Also, the 1960s village life, for me, you talk about you and the 1980s. Well, me and the 1960s, this was just so nostalgic for me that when I was growing up, those were all the cars that were driving around, and that's what village post offices were like, and it just reflected my childhood in so many ways, and it was a delight to kind of be back there and see all that going on and be able to remember my childhood. So I moved then on to the 1995 version. But very sadly, I thought that this was... It just had the very dull feel of a not very interesting remake of something. It had the feel of a kind of 1980s film or TV show, even though, yes, all right, it was in the 90s, but it felt like it was in the style of the 1980s, really. Pretty ropey acting, apart from the main leads, I suppose, with Christopher Reeve. I mean, he was all right, but he wasn't trying very hard. Annoying adult characters. And more annoyingly again is that Carpenter had injected loads of religion into it again, because it's it's in America and Americans seem to all be religious, and you know, there was none of that in the 1960 version, and I'm guessing not in the book either, but they've just injected it in and made one of the key characters the vicar of the religious people. Anyway, laying that aside, focusing back on the kids, the children were given much more to do in this 1995 version. They had much more scope than the original. And the main two or three or four of them did that really well. So, yes, I think that the kids were given more to do, and they did it well, and it worked pretty well. They didn't quite have the same sinister look of the 1960s kids when they were just stood looking, but there you go. Also, Carpenter tried to introduce some silly jump scares into it. There was none of that in the original. It was... He tried to make it more like an alien themed film than the original. There's a big shootout at the end, which is, or you probably loved this big shootout. But the bones of the story, I guess, are somewhat the same as the 1961. But they just made it feel like a 1980s American. Not sitcom exactly, but just an American 1980s film, small town America, and they tried to make it more about they gave you more about the backdrop to what was going on and made it more alien themed. And in the original one, they just that was all suggestion. There was nothing on a plate for you, and because of that, I think. That the 1960s one was much more enjoyable, even though the kids had more to do in the second one. You watched the second one, haven't you?
I did. I hadn't seen that remake. It was one of the John Carpenter movies that I'd ignored, really, to be honest. So I thought I'd take the opportunity, since you mentioned you were going to be watching it, to give it a view as well. And yeah, I thought it was a bit crap, to be honest.
We agree.
By far and away, Carpenter's worst movie, although I will say that in that I haven't seen Ghosts of Mars, but Carpenter's one of my favourite directors, and he just... This felt... I think it's more of a like an American TV movie with that kind of... it's got a really clean look to it.
Yeah.
It's bright and colourful at all stages. It has a fantastic cast, and I have to say, the first 15 minutes... I was rocking this film. I was really enjoying it. I was thinking, this is going to be good. This is going to be a quality diamond in the rough, you know, because you've got Peter Jason, sorry, who passed away recently, who's John Carpenter's go-to guy. You've got Mark Hamill, Michael Parry, Kirstie Alley, Christopher Reeve, Linda Kozolski, who's Paul Hogan's wife, isn't she, from, you know, Crocodile Dundee, Meredith Salinger, and I absolutely loved it. Every name that I saw coming up, I was like, oh yeah absolutely. But as the film went on, I picked up my phone, I got bored, and by the time we got to the climax, I couldn't have given two turds as to whether or not these kids survived or not. I like Christopher Reeve, and I have to say that I haven't seen that many of his films outside of Superman and Street Smart, Grey Lady Down, and Great Escape 2. I've seen that because it's on the 4K as an optional, or as an extra feature on the Great Escape. But, you know, most of his 90s stuff, this was the one he was in before he had his accident. So this was his last big feature film. And he wasn't great. I wonder if it was a paycheck to him, and it's not the sort of film that he saw himself doing. Maybe he was kind of descending to that level. I've just noticed in the trailer there, Buck Flowers is in it as well. He plays the janitor. It's great to see him as well, because he's drinking at the start. If you remember him from Back to the Future, he's a crazy drunk driver, and he always plays an old drunk dude in any films that he happens to be in. But it was pretty woeful. I didn't enjoy this at all, and I was a bit shocked to see some people saying that this is great, and I can't imagine why people like this, because it just doesn't do anything. Even the climax wasn't particularly exciting. There was a shootout, and I put my phone down for that bit and then picked it back up again as the tension ramped. And I couldn't believe the climactic moments where the time is ticking and there's a brick wall And I was like, this is supposed to be tense? it was pants. And exactly, I did a little bit of research into it, and John Carpenter said he wasn't interested in doing this either. It was a contractual obligation, so he just shat something out.
I was like,
fair enough, John. Hats off to you. To be honest, if this is what your shit looks like, then you know, we need some more top-notch things from you, because, you know, you compare this to something like The Thing or Escape from New York.
That last scene in the 1961 with the brick wall is actually full of suspense. You should watch it. You should watch the original.
Yeah, maybe, well, but this remake has taken it out of me. I don't care about those kids anymore. And there was there was another one as well, wasn't there? There was Children of the Damned or something?
Was there?
I think there was another movie in the series.
Oh, right. I didn't know that.
Or a sequel to the first one.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I might read the book. I'm quite keen to see, now I've seen both of those films, which one, you know, took more liberties. I'm guessing the original is very closer to the book. I might read it.
Oh, okay. Check you out and your reading skills.
Yeah,
there was Children of the Damned. It was made in 1964.
Okay.
And it's apparently quite good, according to people.
I'll see if I can track that down then. Okay, but that was quite interesting watching those two films anyway. You had one other?
Well, yeah, just because we were doing kids. Rephrase that. Because we were talking about kids in films. The Omen is a particularly good, scary movie with a kid in it. And I think the kid whose name has letters in it, and it sounds a bit like Harvey Stevens. He was fantastic in The Omen. I really rate that as one of the best kids' portrayals on film ever, because he was genuinely terrifying. And I'm saying this from the point of view, the first time I watched The Omen, I was utterly enthralled. I don't know if you've seen The Omen, but it is one of the finest horror films.
I was scared shitless. I saw this at the cinema when it first came out. I was 14. I wasn't supposed to be in there, but I was a big bloke, a big kid, you know. And I was scared shitless. Some of the imagery and the photography in it was just like spooked me for months on end.
yeah. And Gregory Peck as well, you know. I love whenever they just get a big quality star and put them in what could obviously just work out to be a ropey horror B-movie, but then that just excels it. And he gives a dynamite performance, and the two together, and Lee Remick as well, she's amazing in it too, and David Warner. That's such a phenomenal movie, and Harvey Stevens cements it. He doesn't
seem to have done anything else much.
Could he? He's always going to be compared to that.
Yeah, but his list of credits is only three things, and also huge gaps between each of the three.
Oh yeah, he's in the remake of The Omen and The Omen, and then a TV movie in the 80s.
Yeah, that's strange, isn't it? Perhaps he decided to step away.
Probably, yeah. If anything, maybe from The Omen, he's got a trust fund that was set up, and he's never had to work again.
Yeah, maybe.
Why would you?
But yeah, I agree. I was scared shitless. And I was just spooked for months on end. I used to shut the curtains purposely so that I couldn't see the floating figure outside. It was just really, really spooky.
Yeah.
Just a quick mention for a few others. Danny Lloyd in The Shining. Kirsten Dunst in The Interview with the Vampire, just brilliant performance, I thought. Haley Joel Osment in The Sixth Sense. I watched a bit of that this week, just a few snippets, and it reminded me of how incredibly well he performed in that one as well. Justin Henry played the little boy who I can't remember his name in Kramer versus Kramer.
Good catch, good thinking. Yeah, I forgot about that. Yeah.
And he was really good in that. It was a little bit dated and wooden compared to some of the other ones, but he did a really good job being this kind of kid that was in the middle of this big kind of hoo-ha with all the rest of them. Then I thought of half of the cast of The Sound of Music, which was great, and they all performed really, really well. If you study their performances in that musical, they were really well picked and did a great job. And lastly, I wanted to just give a shout for Natalie Portman in Leon the Professional. Leon the Professional, that was her first film, I think, and it really brought her out. It just showed how... But there's so many... When you start looking at child actors and start to kind of choose one to highlight, there's tons of them, aren't there? Over the hundred and whatever years of cinema, there's been loads and loads of them. And the choice is enormous.
It is, yes. There are lots of children. There tends to be almost as many children as there are parents.
Yes, thank you for that analysis.
Yes, it's deep and meaningful, I know. But yeah, so Leon is a very good one to point out. I think Alan actually mentioned it in the podcast a couple of years ago, but on the Blu-ray or the 4K that came out, there is the other cut of Leon, and if you watch that, oh, you need a shower afterwards because it'll make you feel icky and dirty.
I've seen those. I've seen that extended cut. I didn't think I didn't think it was as bad as people had kind of made it out to be. But yeah, it was a bit untasteful for sure.
Yes.
But yeah, there you go. That was my lot. Right, your turn next time. What are you picking for our theme?
Well, I thought we haven't done a sports movie, so basketball.
Basketball. Not an American sport.
you don't have to go for some sort of sports movie. You could just have something that's centered around a basketball.
Yeah.
You know, Woodsman, that's centered around a basketball.
Fine. Yep, okay, no problem. So we'll do basketball on the next show, so watch out for that one, everyone. And then we're going to go to the main feature. In the coming soon, I think on the last show or the one before that, I can't remember, we had a quick look at this film called The Drift, which is also known as Ice Skater. And it popped up on Apple TV, and I thought I'd give it a go. It's a survival drama about an ice skater stranded on an ice floe in the Arctic Sea. When the ice floe starts to float towards the south and melt, the ice skater must use all means necessary to survive. Now, I did a review of this, and I'll link to it in the show notes, but... The main problem I had with this film was that they'd used so much CGI, AI. I went on a Discovery tour with Geminis trying to work out, because half of it looked as though it was animated. And this is a Finnish film, which apparently was really low budget. And I discovered that the main character in the film, called Emily, tended to look a bit like a high-end video game character half the time, and apparently this is because of AI enhanced digital doubling, and it saves costs. It just kind of, there's a scene with some polar bears in it. It's just so obvious that they're not real and they're just created, and it kind of takes it away from it. I think we spoke about this before, where you've got a film where the storyline and the impact of what's going on makes up for that kind of thing. But in this one, I don't think there was enough there, really. The story about the girl, another thing about the setting is that she's on this 20 foot by 20 foot bit of ice, and whenever you see a long shot of the bit of ice, it's completely still. It's so static. It's not moving with the sea at all. And it just makes you, again, it makes you think, this is inside, even if this is not CGI, at best it's going to be in some tank somewhere, which has been rooted to the floor. No attention to detail at all that has gone along with that. The other thing is that half the time you're not really quite sure if what's going on is real or whether she is imagining stuff. It is quite moving at times, and she, I think she, looking past her digital game show character thing, and I think she as an actor has done pretty well in it, and, you know, it is quite moving, and I won't tell you what the outcome is, but in actual fact, when you see the outcome, you're not 100% sure at the end whether it's real or whether it's not happened or happened. There's a lot of ambiguity going on in the whole ending of the film, and throughout, really. But there's a real feeling of isolation here. That what it is good at is showing, you know, her plight. She's stuck on this thing. She's getting hungry. She's getting thirsty. She tries to drink the seawater and quickly spits it out. She starts to, because the sea is warming up, bits of the 20-foot thing she's on starts to break away, and in the end she's on a really tiny bit of a bit of the ice that's left, and she's got a bag of sweets, and she tries to ration herself with these sweets throughout. But yeah, so there's quite a lot in here that you could take away and say, yeah, that's okay, they've done that quite well, the storyline kind of holds it together. But in this case, I think that the CGI just spoils it, particularly when the polar bear, who is equally hungry with her cub, comes up to her little tent, and all she has to do is zip herself up in her tent, and the polar bear gives up and goes away. Well, she would have been eaten by that polar bear, no question at all. And also, she ends up in this ice cold water at one point for a, you know, she would not have survived in this water for a. But then we go back to the whether or not the thing is happening or not, and it's all a bit ambiguous and hallucinatory at times, I think, but not sure. You've got to kind of read into it what you want to some degree. And I've waffled enough about it now, so I will finish.
Well, I was quite interested in listening there. I'm a bit disappointed, I suppose. I thought this looked really good. I was quite excited for it.
Well, give it a go then.
I will, absolutely. I think I'll watch it this weekend. It sounds fun. What's your Apple TV, you said it was on, didn't you?
It is, yeah. But you do have to pay a few pennies or use a, what's it, if you haven't got a, even if you are an Apple TV subscriber, you still have to pay a few pennies.
I suppose even whenever you think about the idea of her being out on the ice, if they were to film it up in the Arctic Sea, it would be incredibly dangerous.
It would.
Just to film it there.
It's just low budget. If money had been spent on this film, they could have made it look brilliant, even though they weren't in the Finnish waters in the Arctic Sea. It's just that it was all just clearly on a tight budget. And I'll actually be really interested to see what you think of it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, these types of films, I know, where people are trapped in a small confined space, like Buried, and what was that one where the car was stuck in the mud?
Oh, yeah.
Buried in the mud.
I can't remember now.
They come out quite frequently, and it's always unusual and interesting to see where they think of next. Mm-hmm. I remember sitting talking to a girl in work, and she said that she went on holiday and she had a terrible time because she went out onto the balcony, and the French doors behind her clicked and locked, and she was stuck out there for the best part of a day in the beating sun. I was like, ooh, that almost sounds like it might make a good thriller, aside from it being stupid.
Yeah.
And she came back in and had to get some after sun. That was funny. Yeah. Right, okay. Well, that's cool. I'll give that a go at the weekend, I think. I watched a TV series that is doing the rounds here. I don't know how celebrated it is across the water on the mainland, or if it's even doing the rounds in America or something like that, but it's quite a personal TV series because it's got the name of the city that is just down the road from me. It's called How to Get to Heaven from Belfast. And it's from the writer Lisa McGee, who did Derry Girls, a TV series I am not enthusiastic about. But I figured I'd give this a go because my wife told me I needed to give this a go and she wanted to watch it. So we've been watching it. And it's all right. I can't put it in flop of the fortnight because I don't hate it, but I just find it, it's a very complex series that tries to be an awful lot more than it actually works out to be. You've seen In Bruges, haven't you?
Yeah.
With Colin Farrell.
I have.
And most of the comedy in Bruges comes from Colin Farrell's personality.
Uh-huh.
His wee Northern Ireland type personality where he says certain things that come off to be most witty in that Belfast-y type of way.
Mm-hmm.
This has three leads who are of that calibre. They talk exceptionally fast. They're somewhat brutal. They are mean. But, you know, where they're mean, they... in that Belfast way, because we are all arseholes over here, they are mean from the point of view that there's no harm in it, really. They're constantly sceptical about things because Northern Ireland people just don't believe you. Whenever I started doing talk sport, I would tell some people that did that and they wouldn't believe me at all. And I had to prove it to them. And it was just like, when you go to America and say, yeah, I'm on the radio. And they're like, wow, man, tell us more. Whereas here, it's like, no, you're fucking not. Let's hear it. Let's hear it now. If you can't play it to me now, then it's not true.
Look, are you going to tell us what this thing's about? Tell us what's the storyline in this thing?
All right. It's about... Well, it's a bit more of a serious story than you might be expecting from something that's supposed to be a comedy.
Ah.
It's about three or four girls who do something whenever they are quite young, and three of them have to try and piece together a mystery that is connected to what happened to them whenever they were young. And it takes them all over, well, Ireland, out to Portugal and back again, and they meet all of these weird and wacky characters along the way as they try to piece together what the fuck's going on.
Sounds all right.
It's an intriguing enough story.
Yeah.
It's just, it's hard to get through because it has such a modern feel forced upon it. Whilst I think the cast are particularly good, and Roisin Gallagher, who's from Andy's Town up in Belfast, she is phenomenal. Absolutely anchors this in every way. She's an absolutely brilliant actress. Really, she makes this show tolerable. The other two girls in the lead, Sinead Keenan and I'm not even going to try that. Miss Dunn, who plays Dara, the two of them are pretty good and kind of work off Roisin's leading role, you know, it, and they become quite a good trio at the center of the story. But the production side of things has decided to make this really modern and snappy, so there is a constant use of, I'm not even going to say modern pop songs, I'm going to say late 90s pop songs, where, you know, it a lot of songs can open with a really fun and energetic opening, like Spice Girls or something like that, and you identify it straight away. And whenever you hear it coming on the radio, you know it. And a lot of cuts happen whenever they move from one scene to another scene. You suddenly get this blast of an older pop tune. And then it starts to mellow out, and it's trying to keep itself hip and trendy with the young kids. And it, it becomes really tiresome after a while. And I suppose maybe if you're watching it week to week, it might be okay and you might think this is great. But, you know, I watched about three or four episodes four nights in a row, and it started to get to me. And it was constantly being hip and trendy and modern. It was like, okay, settle down. Now let's get into the story and let's just enjoy this. But it doesn't. It keeps, you know, ripping things up, and then all of a sudden it's playing this new tune and they're going off on this zippy wild chase or something like that. And it's not what I was looking for from this at all. And it's almost like it's continually trying to win you over like a TV series should do in the first half hour. And then after that, you know, it can settle down and reel you in. It's too much.
Have you seen
all the time?
Have you seen Dougal yet?
Yes, I have. I was about to say. Right. He is the clear winner out of this. Ardlan O'Hanlon is in there, and I have the pleasure of being able to say that I met Ardlan about 25 years ago.
Yeah.
And he is hilarious. He's not in it very much. He has basically one scene per episode.
Yeah.
And if you watch the first episode, you'll see his scene and you'll get exactly what he's doing.
Right.
And he's the funniest thing in the whole thing. Some of the lines are quite snappy and pretty cool. A lot of them are quite obvious, and you can feel that, you know, they've been thrown in because, you know, they've got to keep the comedy up, so they're looking for more comedy here and there. It's not hilarious or cutting-edge comedy. It is, you know, it's quite tried and tested comedy, but it's got a new take on it because it's been done from a Northern Ireland point of view. Bruna Gallagher is fantastic. Another one that I can say I spent the day with Bruna Gallagher back in 25 years ago on a film called The Most Fertile Man in Ireland. She's a phenomenal wit, and she's quite well used here, but I still feel she's underused because she's a lot better than the role she's playing. And then there is the girl from Derry Girls, whose name I don't know, but she has a really quirky character, and is the most out there character in the whole thing. And my wife thinks she's absolutely superb. To me, I just felt like it was like, we've got to throw in a really wacky character, and here's that wacky character, and she's wacky in the way that wacky characters are wacky. Stereotypical wacky.
Why didn't you like Derry Girls?
Because I didn't find it very funny at all.
Oh, right, okay.
And I think it's probably in that Northern Irish way. I don't like fellow countrymen who are successful. Yeah.
That's what Alan would say. I'm not watching that because they wouldn't let me act in it.
Well, yes, that. You know what? Alan Paul and I wrote a banger of a TV series and it got turned down. Whereas old Lisa McGee, she was like, she's got two of them now. So she's been successful, so obviously her TV shows are fucking shit. But that's Northern Ireland for, yeah, she's well done. Well done, Lisa.
Very, very aggressive.
But yeah, it's a hard watch, I would say, but I think a lot of people will get more mileage out of it if they stretch it apart and watch it every once in a while, or one episode a week, maybe two episodes a week,
right.
And you might get the benefits of it. It's not bad. It's an interesting story, and it's got dark themes. It's got a wee bit of horror. It's got a wee bit of ghosty supernatural stuff going on, but it's just peppered with a wee bit too much comedy and energy. It's tiring.
Okay, I might have a look at it. I think Douglas made me give it a go, even if he's only in it for 2 minutes.
Yeah. He needs more. He needs his own TV series. What was the one that he was in? Was it My Family or something like that? That TV series that ran through?
When he was an alien.
Oh, was it?
My Hero. Something about Hero.
My Hero, yes. 45 Hero? Episodes. Flipping
yeah,
out.
Yeah. And he was an alien, wasn't he? I remember watching that.
I'm just looking at the cover of it. He's barely on the cover. He's sort of hidden down at the bottom corner. And everyone else who's in it, all the British cast are front and centre. And he's way down there.
I remember watching that. And it's very kind of low budget. It's not badly written, though. You know, some of the lines are quite good, I seem to remember. But the whole kind of, and the girl as well, the girl that was in it, she was I seem to remember that she was a very good little actress. I can't remember her name, though. Anyway, there you go.
If you get a chance and you want to investigate Ardal O'Hanlon a bit more, go onto YouTube and have a look for Flying Saucer Rock and Roll.
Okay.
It's by a guy called Enda Hughes, and it was written by Mick Duffy, who I worked with. And you can't see, I didn't make the cut, but I'm in the cinema scene with a bunch of my mates.
Oh, right.
And it's a cracker of a movie. It's only like 10 minutes long, but it was one of the most inventive and interesting films to come out of Northern Ireland for a long time.
Okay, cool. Okay, so How to Get to Heaven from Belfast 2026. Links in the show notes for all of these from the main feature, of course. And now it's time for Coming Soon. What do we have in Coming Soon?
Well, we're going to start with something that I ignored whenever I first saw, but now I realize it's not what I thought it was. Bases of Death. The first thing I read about this was that it was a remake of the original Faces of Death, which, if you've heard of it,
yeah, I have.
Yeah,
and I thought, and I when I saw this in the recording notes, I thought that's what it was until I saw the date.
Yeah. Faces of Death was an early compilation from like 1978 or so, where it collected together real footage of people dying.
Allegedly.
Yes, being killed on film, and put them together into a film and released. And it got multiple parts. I think they got up to like part six or something like that. And it was just one of those sick, terrible TV series that, or not TV series, but videos that you never wanted to see. but there's a new movie coming out that is something to do with that. And, you know, now I think about it, I think I forgot to watch the trailer. I put it in and went, oh, I'll watch that, and then forgot to watch it. But because it's a proper narrative, it's a proper movie about the Faces of Death, so it might actually hook in to the legacy of those older films and be something more recognisable and a bit more tasteful. What did you think of the trailer?
I think you're probably right. I think that it, you know, it's there's lots of handheld camera going on and this whole found footage thing and people making videos in spooky rooms and stuff. I don't know. I think I'd much rather see a proper story than stuff like this. It does look quite scary in places, but I don't know the background. I don't know if it's in any way like the proper Faces of Death, or tries to be, or pretends to be, or whatever.
Fair enough. Okie doke. Well, moving on, because it could be good, it could be bad. 500 Miles is a new Irish drama with your mate Bill Nighy. this is about two brothers who run away from home in England to reach their estranged grandfather on Ireland's west coast. Which is like, you know, Cliffs of Moher, that kind of thing. And this looks like a fairly decent little drama. Ted, did you like this?
It looked really dull and boring to me. But I do like Bill Nighy, as you said. And I also like Maisie Williams, who's in it. And she was in that comedy, kind of dark comedy, 2 Weeks to Live, that I brought to the show a while back. And going back even further, she was in The Falling, which was that film about these schoolgirls that fell. and the Book of Love she was in as well. Anyway, the point is that Maisie Williams was on my radar, and when I saw her in this, I thought, oh yeah, I know her. And with Bill Nighy, it might just push me over the edge to have a go, even though it looks really dull and boring in terms of a story.
Fair enough. What a way to describe it. Yeah, okay. Right. Next up is... I have to say John Oliver was the one who turned me on to this because I had to have a look after he mentioned it in his show. But Joe Nesbo's Detective Hole is a new detective series featuring Detective Hole coming to Netflix. And Detective Hole goes out and investigates stuff whilst being called Harry Hole. Obviously, this is not English. It's a Norwegian thing, but the fact that his last name is Hole is really funny, I think.
Let me fill in the gaps for you. Joe Nesbo is an author and created Harry Hole the Detective. I read
Harry
one
what?
Of Harry Hole. I read one of these books. I read The Snowman. And
would you read the whole thing?
And there's a whole series of these books that have Harry Hole in it. The Bat, the Red Breast, the Cockroaches, the Devil's Star, and so on. So if you are
there's lots you could really go down a rabbit.
You're on the ball today, aren't you? And yes, you're right. It is Scandinavian. And books are actually... My sister has read all the books and told me that they are really, really good. And she'll be all over this. And she'll be going down that rabbit hole as well. So that's the background to this. And I think it looks as though it's quite well made from the trailer. It looks dark and sinister, but then I think most of the Joe Nesbo things are dark and sinister. When I read The Snowman, I can remember thinking, it's not terribly exciting. But when I told my sister that, she said, I think you picked the wrong one, because actually most of the books are really good. So anyway, there's your background.
Well, I do think it looks pretty interesting. I like Joel Kinnaman, who is in For All Mankind, and he was the remake RoboCop. So that should balance it out quite well. So Peter Stormare's in there, who's always good. I think this sounds like it's worth a go.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah, it's just a shame that they called the character Detective Hole.
Well, that's been around for a long time.
Now you can take your books and shove them up your...
1997. This is not new.
Oh, the books are?
Yeah.
But the new TV show is
coming to
Netflix.
Yeah.
On March 26th, which is in 19 days.
Mm.
No, it's not. No, today's the 5th of March. It's in 21 days.
Ooh. Very clever. Well done.
It might be 19 days by the time they listen to this. The next is Mother's Pride. Mother's Pride. I don't recognize this at all. Did I put this in here?
No, I put it in. And I couldn't make up my mind about it, really. It looks like one of these twee Brit comedies. The cast is really good. So Martin Clunes takes the lead. Mark Addy is in there from that supermarket thingy.
Full Monty.
Oh, yes, that's right. He was in the Full Monty as well, wasn't he? Josie Lawrence, who we used to all love. James Buckley from Zapped. Miles Jupp and a load more people. A grieving family who own a failing pub have their lives changed by brewing real ale and entering the Great British Beer Awards. So just by that, you can just tell it's some British twee comedy, and it could be crap or it could be funny, it could be light and fluffy for family viewing, which it stinks of Martin Clunes, doesn't it, being just Martin Clunes being twee and awfully nice and you know, from British sitcom land almost. But as always with these things, it'll come down to how well it's been written and how funny it is and what I don't know. I think it could go either way.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned Miles Jupp. I don't know him from anything other than panel shows, but I've always found him to be really witty on those panel shows. Yeah. He does 8 out of 10 Cats and Would I Lie to You and things like that.
Yeah.
But I haven't actually seen him in anything, and I know he was in a TV series, was it? What's the story in Ballamore, that thing. But I've never actually come across him acting.
Okay. Well, now's your chance.
Yeah, he's got a huge filmography that goes all the way back to 2001.
It might be just far too twee to be stomachable. It's the kind of thing that my dad would probably watch and think it's frightfully, frightfully nice because it's so frightfully British.
Well, you know, I don't think you can ever fault Clunes. Clunes is a national treasure. I love the man, and mm-hmm. I will forever watch anything that he's in. I even watched Nativity 3, wasn't it?
I don't know that, yeah.
I mean, and Josie Lawrence, good to see her back on the
screen. Yeah, totally. She's really funny.
Yeah. Cool, yeah. No, that looks good. I'll give that a go.
Okay.
And finally, Normal.
We did this.
We did.
We did it in show 200, the last one that Alan was on. And we all, I think, said it looks really interesting. Because it starts off with the cop being like Bob Odenkirk being like he is on Fargo, this kind of this kind of nice cop who wouldn't say boo to a goose, and then halfway through the film he turns into the bloke from Nobody and starts kicking the shit out of everyone. Do you remember now?
Yeah, oh no, I do, absolutely. And I remember this new trailer coming out. I don't remember putting it in, but I think I was planning to put it in.
Okay.
Yeah, this does look like a great amount of fun. And it looks better than Nobody and Nobody 2. I think I'd rather watch this. Because it's got a wee hint to Fargo about it, too.
Yes, definitely. The first half of the film looks like he is the cop in Fargo who's just Mr. Nice Guy and doesn't want any trouble with anyone and wants an easy life and, oh, for goodness sake, don't stir that up again. Molly, there's a Molly. Don't stir that up again, Molly. Just leave that. We can leave that. Oh, I love Fargo.
Yeah.
Right, okay, so that's the coming soons. The final curtain, we have two people to consider.
Well, yes, we've lost Bobby Carradine, who is the middle son, I think, of John Carradine. He's the brother of Keith, and I think there was Bruce Carradine as well, and Christopher Carradine. Yeah, there were four of them, of John Carradine's first round of children, and then he had a few extra ones with David Carradine, and then
is David the Kung Fu one?
Yes,
right, okay. David.
And I think he made a couple of films with Robert Carradine as well. But Robert was also the uncle of Martha Plimpton as well, who I remember she was in Goonies and a couple of films with River Phoenix as well. But Robert Carradine was such a difficult actor to pin down in a particular type of role. He made everything, and he did it with so much ease. I would say that he is probably best known for the films Revenge of the Nerds and Revenge of the Nerds 2, Revenge of the Nerds 3, and Revenge of the Nerds 4. where he played Lewis, the buck-tooth nerd, with a tank toppy type thing, one of those jumpers without sleeves. And he was synonymous with that role. However, he made so many other films that were just completely the opposite end. And one in particular, which I reviewed on my site, called Number One with a Bullet, which is practically Lethal Weapon. You know, it's amazing just to see him move from that act, from that character to another character, you know, in a couple of years. And as you look through his filmography, you get to see him. There was one film called, and he's got a gruff beard, and he is just, you know, action hero. And it's hard to think of him as that. There's Firestorm, which he was in, and then, you know, from John Carpenter as well, Escape from L.A. But he just can move so easily from one type of character to another type of character. It's phenomenal. I first became aware of Robert Carradine from Cannonball, which is sometimes called Carquake, which is I think David Carradine's in it. Yeah, he's the star. And it's like a precursor to the Cannonball Run. It's much more serious and a lot more violent. But it's just a big car chase comedy has a bunch of wacky characters trying to make it from sea to shining sea. Sounds a bit like Cannonball Run. And it has that feel to it, but whilst being more violent. And he was in there. And then there was a war film with Lee Marvin that Mark Hamill was in. And I was excited about seeing it because Mark Hamill was in there, because he was the guy from Star Wars and Village of the Damned. And he and Robert Carradine was in that too as well. It was a big wartime epic. And it's just bizarre to see Lewis from Revenge of the Nerds in all these other films, and serious films, action films, and that kind of thing. And looking at his filmography, you know, he's done over 150 films. He still has 7 due to arrive, which are all in post-production, so we still have a decent amount of films to go. But his star did wane a bit over the years, and some of the films that he made in the last 10 years are not quite the crackers that you might remember. Whilst he was in Django Unchained, he was also in Sharktopus versus Pterodactyl, and he starred in that as well, which, you know, was a cheap genre movie, and Deep Winter and 7-10 Split, you know, these kind of trashy little direct-to-video films that are obviously just, you know, a film for him to do, a paycheck for him, and maybe have some fun while he's doing it. But he's worked with most of the great directors over the years, and had a wild and varied career. Do you know Mr. Carradine?
No, I know the Carradine name because of David and because of Kung Fu. But I would never have known any of these other people, including him. And I tried to track down some of the things that I knew that he'd been in. Escape from L.A. I've seen. Django Unchained, you just mentioned, I've seen. Orca the Killer Whale. I thought that was a great film. And I've seen all of those. But I think that unless I go back to the film and look at it and try and track down who he's played in there, I don't stand a chance really knowing who it is. And this is often the case with me, I'm afraid, is that I don't know these actors well enough to know the backdrop as well as you do. But he was 71, apparently.
Yes, he suffered from bipolar disorder and unfortunately decided to take his own life, because I think, well, obviously that must be a very difficult thing to deal with, and it was a horrible thing for the family to have to experience. But I had a look into his upbringing and things like that, because obviously John Carradine is a well-known, recognizable actor. And he appears to be a man with an incredible heart, who was married a number of times and there were children involved in those marriages, maybe prior to the marriage, and he kept those children. He he provided for those children, and he ended up with a large family of about 8 or 9 kids, including some that were his, and then some that were, you know, not adopted, but, you know, kids to women that he was married to. And his second wife, the mother of Keith and Robert and Christopher, was had I believe mental problems, and they hid who Robert's mother was from him for many years, and he believed that his stepmother that John would go on to marry after having the children was actually his mother, until his brother Keith told him at the age of 14 or something they happened to be in the same room as their real mother, and Keith told him that is our mother. And that must be something else to have to deal with. But yeah, he was a really solid actor. During the 80s, he was a leading man, and then it waned off a wee bit in the 90s, and then he became just a character actor in direct-to-video films for the next couple of decades, with the odd starring role, but a very reliable and decent actor. And it's very sad to hear him go at a fairly young age too. So the other name that we lost was Rob Grant, who was one of the writers of Red Dwarf. Not the whole series of Red Dwarf. I believe he left after Red Dwarf 6, 7, 7, 8 kind of time, and went on to develop some of his own other projects, but he had written for the likes of Spitting Image, and then he and Doug Naylor created Red Dwarf, and it came from Dave the Holistic Space Adventure or something like that. It was a radio play that they had based off of Dark Star. Also directed by John Carpenter. This is a John Carpenter podcast. So they'd seen Dark Star, wrote this radio play about it, and then they decided to expand that radio play into what is now Red Dwarf. And we've had, a phenomenal amount of Red Dwarf, and I don't think the quality's still there anymore after Rob Grant left. But, I think a lot of people have a lot of good things to say about Red Dwarf. I'm actually most of the way through Red Dwarf, watching it again with my son. We're on Red Dwarf 10 now, so I do plan to talk about Red Dwarf in the coming weeks or months, depending on how long it takes us to get to the most recent outing. But I think he has penned a new book as well for Red Dwarf that will hopefully be released at some point, maybe this year or next, which would be nice to see, because he hasn't done too much in the way of Red Dwarf since he left the partnership back around Red Dwarf 7 or 8. Someone correct me if they like. Obviously, Ted, you know Rob Grant, don't you?
Not at all, no. Never heard of him. But when I started to look into it, well, firstly, I would say that Red Dwarf was just not on my radar. I know what it is, and I've watched a few episodes of it. It doesn't particularly grab me as particularly funny. So it's just not for me. I don't particularly go with it. It might be to do with the age I am as well, and if I'd been a different age when it started, perhaps I would have been more into it. But I did notice from his backlog that he was involved in writing for Carrot's Lib. Now it's my turn to leave you out in the cold, because Jasper Carrot, when I was growing up, was very much the comedian of the moment, and Carrot's Lib was a TV show, and I really enjoyed watching Jasper Carrot. Thought he was really, really funny. So there's that, and there's also the TV show that I've brought to the show before, which apparently he was involved in writing for, which is called Pushing Up Daisies, 1984. If you're in America, it's just called Pushing Daisies, but the original title was Pushing Up Daisies.
Does that make sense? Pushing Daisies?
I don't know, but the Americans decided to take the up out, but there you go. And so that show I've spoken about on this podcast before, and I think it's really good, and it's a kind of missed jewel, I think, out there. It's really funny, and it's really inventive, and it's really interesting concept of what's going on, and he was involved in writing with that, so good for that. And also, I was the right age, I think, for Spitting Image, and I thought Spitting Image was fantastic. And so I know that Spitting Image had tons and tons of writers, so who knows what bit of it he did and what he didn't, sort of thing. But even so, yeah, it's a good credit, so very sad.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, that brings us to the end of that, then.
And the end of the podcast. So thank you for listening, everyone who's made it through the 2 hours nearly. And just some reminders, GarethMiles.com is where you'll find Gareth's stuff and writings on what he's watching and other stuff as well. TedSalmon.com is where you'll find everything else that we do, audio podcasts, MeWe groups, all the rest of that. ProjectorRoom.co.uk is our website where you'll find links to all the stuff we've been talking about today. And we will see you in the MeWe group, we hope, where you will tell us what you've been watching so we can bring highlights of that to the shows going forward when we bring them to you every fortnight, which we shall do in 2 weeks' time from now. In fact, from yesterday, when we hope you'll join us again in the Projector Room.